Welcome to The Secret Truth. I'm George Butler. Boy, we've got the favorite guest of all time with us, Tony Gosling from Bristol, England. And welcome to our program, Tony.
Hi, George. Lovely to hear from you again.
Boy, I tell you what, there's a lot going on in that party over there, the Labour Party and the Tories. And what did you mention earlier when we were talking offline about who might be the new Prime Minister to replace Theresa May? Tell us about that.
Yeah, well, of course, the thing is to remember the background to May. She was a Remainer in the referendum campaign, 2016, and so then she became Prime Minister of Brexit Britain. So she's kind of the most interesting thing about her, I think, is her husband, Philip May, who works for this big Los Angeles-based investment firm who with big shares in Lockheed, Starbucks, Amazon, some of the big pharmaceutical companies. So really she is a gopher for him. So when you see Theresa May in charge, you know that the various things like appointments to the security committees, etc., he's going to have a say in that. He's going to have an influence in that. I mean, she would deny that, of course, but anyone with half a brain cell can see that the money power is wearing the trousers, not Theresa May. She's an easy to manipulate person. Quite clearly, you know, she's changed from being, you know, she's got no real principles from Remain to, so supposedly now she's a diehard Brexiteer, and also she was in charge of the introducing the Snoopers Charter, which was this thing that the secret state wanted to have in Britain, which would allow them to spy on everybody.
Oh my God.
And retain all their data, this kind of thing. So that's who she is. The other thing, she never got elected to be leader. There's 120,000 members of the Conservative Party, and not one of them had any say in her being a leader. There was about to be an election, and Andrea Leadsom, who was the only person left standing against her, stood down one weekend, in the middle of last year. So Theresa May was crowned Queen of England, you know. So that's the situation we're in. The other thing is, of course, with this ridiculous general election that she called, which I would say was 100% really because of what was going on in the Labour Party, that general election was called. I mean, she's obviously been manipulated into doing it because it was a almost political suicide, as it turned out, for her to get rid of her majority, to then have to rely on the Democratic Unionist Party,
right,
in order to stay in Downing Street. So the reason was because we had a Labour Party reselections and deselections going on in May and August. That meant that the Blairite MPs in the Labour Party, the new Corbynistas don't like and also attack Corbyn constantly. They're also very pro-European Union. They're pro the wars like the Syria war, Iraq war, the sort of people that would have voted for the Iraq war, etc. They would have been deselected in May and June. The only thing was the general election came and got in the way, so all these Blairites have been replaced and put back in to the House of Commons for another 5 years. So that's why a lot of people have scratched their heads and saying, why did Theresa May call this general election? Well, here's the evidence. She wasn't doing it in the Tory party interest. She was doing it in the interest of the New World Order, in the interest of the war machine, and in the interests of Brussels. So that's the background to it all. But the possible person who's going to take over, keep your eye on him, from Theresa May, because she's got no political authority. She's a disaster as a Prime Minister, calling a general election, which ended up, you know, destroying the Tory majority, even though it was supposed to do the opposite.
Right.
Is this guy called Jacob Rees-Mogg. Now, his father was the editor of the Times, William Rees-Mogg, and Jacob is an investment banker in the Conservative Party. He's very much a pro-Brexit, and he's one of the sorts of people who I think will be loving to run Britain independent from Brussels once Brexit's happened, George. And he's actually a local MP just close to Bristol, near Bath.
Right. Does this battle between the Tories and Labour go back to the Peterloo massacre? I know Corbyn was cited that at the Glastonbury Festival recently.
Well, look, it goes back, I think, probably further than that. And also, at the moment, we've got half of the Labour Party who are basically Tories. That is to say, the Blairite half. And so Corbyn has got a bit of a battle on his hands just to keep some sort of control over the... I mean, you know, it's interesting to watch the difference in the tactics of the left and the right. Right, I mean, you know, when there's a dispute, they tend to deal with these disputes behind closed doors in a cloak and dagger fashion, or else it's like a, you know, duels with pistols at dawn, and no one's supposed to know about it, but somebody dies, you know, or somebody is politically destroyed.
Right.
Whereas the Labour Party seem to enjoy fighting in public, you know, and this is probably true of the left right across the world, is they love having a go in the press, and of course the right-wing press loves this and publicises it, you know, much more than it would disputes with on the right. You'll see one faction having a go at another faction in the left, so it just gives an impression that the left is in complete disarray. Actually, in a way, I think it's better to have that left-wing attitude, which is where you're honest about the differences. Right. Whereas, of course, the differences in the Conservative Party, which have been there for many, many years over Europe, for example, it's almost as if they're in denial about it. So they try and just keep that all secret from the public.
Right. Well, that,
until they have something, you know, like a referendum.
You know, that Ofcon was put through during a Labour Party faction by a Labour Party minister, was it not?
Say that again.
Yeah, I believe that the Ofcon agency, you know, the one that regulates all communications, it was put through during a labor-dominated government, and I believe a woman that was labor, a minister, put it through. So I guess,
well, that's right.
You know, it's a mixed bag, yeah, I mean, then sometimes, isn't it, huh?
Well, look, the Ofcom is a terribly unaccountable organisation.
Right,
really,
right.
Any kind of press regulation, listen, you've got your own problems with the FCC in the US, but look, any kind of press regulation organisation really should be run by people who have been victims of the press, I think.
Yes.
It shouldn't be people appointed by the establishment. It should be people who know how much the press can destroy your life. And I'm not talking about the rich and powerful, because that's actually what the press is there for. The rich and powerful should be taken down by, you know, criticised. And, of course, they should be big enough to take that criticism in the national press and international press. What I object to is when you see up-and-coming talent, artists, journalists, etc., being destroyed in the mainstream press, where they don't have any kind of right of reply. So these are the sorts of people I think should be regulating the press, and then we'd start to see the press behaving themselves. You know, it's very, I think in journalism generally, you should have a kind of sliding scale. If someone is poor and powerless, then you should not really be writing exposés on them. If someone is rich and powerful, you should be writing everything. But of course, the opposite is the case, because the rich and powerful take media proprietors to court and sue them for hundreds of thousands of pounds, sometimes enough to close a newspaper down. Whereas, of course, the poor just simply can't do anything. They have no ability to take the press to court. So that's why you get the press kind of tiptoeing around the rich and powerful and sometimes just having a go at poor people, because they know there's not going to be any comeback, George.
Right. I know the Guardian got its start there at the Peterloo massacre. I think that paper was founded at that time.
The local Manchester
newspaper folded.
That's right. The thing is, in Britain, pretty much all of our press is concentrated in London.
Right.
All the international national coverage, pretty much. Even the Guardian, of course, moved to London eventually, because I guess they just think it's more prestigious. Maybe their financial backers told them to, because the financial backers, of course, are the ones you've got to watch. And the Manchester Guardian, for a long time, was a regional press that was doing a fantastic job covering national and international issues from Manchester. I mean, there is a lot in Glasgow, Scottish press, the Herald and other Scottish newspapers there. But I think it's very, very unhealthy. Germany, for example, is much better, where they have the press spread out across all the major cities, have got their own national newspaper in Germany. And Britain is completely opposite. Everything's concentrated in London. So you end up with this journalistic bubble. It's also very easy to control. So as soon as you start to get journalists who are saying what the establishment don't want, they're quite close by in London, and they can have a word in the right ear and make sure that journalist gets the sack.
Right. There have been a recent riot over here at Dalston. Did you cover that at all or look into it? and there was a student there out of the, it's making some remarks about white people or something. He's African or something.
Well, look, I mean, I've been covering some of the riots in Britain, in East London,
right,
which are to do with deaths in police custody of black people,
right,
which have been getting very little coverage, and that seems to be, you know, really quite worrying. Even even people who've been shot dead, for example,
right,
usually ethnic minority people. Now, look, we know that ethnic minorities tend to be poorer, and actually the organised crime is there deliberately as a way for people to make a living. When they're living in a city where it's very, very difficult to make a living and to keep your dignity, actually organised crime presents the way to keep your dignity. I know it sounds awful, but there is honour amongst thieves, and you know, people can make a career in organised crime. I wouldn't advise it. I know it's criminal, I know it's illegal, but the thing is, this is the way that the capitalist system in the West works, is that actually it favours organised crime. And there are all sorts of bribes that are paid to officials by organised crime, as we know, in order for them to stay in existence. And you'll find that the police and the serious organisations like the FBI in the States, MI5 in Britain, etc., just leave them well alone. They don't touch the organised crime because they like to have them on side, you know, so they build up a relationship with you. So you end up with the FBI and MI5, the so-called security services, etc., actually being very, very close to. We have something called the Serious Organised Crime Agency in Britain, which is a little bit like the FBI, but they're basically in their pocket. So, unfortunately, when it comes to ethnic minorities, they are very often, as a lot of poor white people are, sucked into organised crime. And this is, I think, there's a nod and a wink to these people, and they turn up, and the officials turn a blind eye to organised crime because they know that that some of the people who are part of that are quite close to their bosses, etc., and very close to government, actually.
Right. What about the mayor there of London, Sadiq Khan? He's saying that maybe the Labour Party ought to pursue a policy of staying in the European Union and cancelling Brexit out. What do you think?
Well, look, he's not really on the programme, is he, when it comes to democracy? There was a vote. There's a lot of people, George, we call them the Remainiacs, who are, despite the vote, they are saying, we're going to stay in the EU, we're going to stay in the single market. Listen, we've got to get out, man. We've got to get out. And at least then we can deal with our own problems here in Britain. At the moment, we're being dominated by a very powerful oligarchy. I just was looking at, for example, her name's Patricia McKenna. She's an Irish former Green member of the European Parliament from the 1990s, and I was working with some of her people back then looking at the Bilderbergs, and she was asking questions about Bilderberg in the European Parliament at the time. Needless to say, she didn't last long, and needless to say, the Green Party in Britain and Ireland, the policy changed to be pro-EU. So they were anti-EU to begin with, and that everything got kind of manipulated from above in order to change the policy and to get rid of Patricia. But she was explaining how the European Defence Agency, which is created, it was originally called a lobbying organisation, but then it changed its name to the European Defence Agency, and you would wonder, well, what role do they play in foreign policy? Well, she points out that they have a very, very powerful and big role in actually defining EU foreign policy. And who is the European Defence Agency? Well, it's, surprise, surprise, it's the arms industry lobby. So the arms industry is helping to set, in fact, it's playing a major part in actually saying which countries should and shouldn't be invaded, who should be put into sanctions, etc. So there's actually no moral or public or democratic input whatsoever into the foreign policy of the European Union, which is another reason why we've got to get out.
Right. This Jacob Rees-Mogg, was he, his father connected back to the Tavistock Institute?
Quite possibly. But the thing is that Rees-Mogg looks as if he's going to take over, doesn't he? So he's also been embroiled in the past in various... There are rumours, and I can't really go into them at the moment, but
sure,
there are very strong rumours that he has documents with which he can blackmail other senior Conservatives, and that may well be one of the reasons why he's managed to wheedle his way into being in a key position to take over the Tory party. You know, he's a bit of an operator. He's extremely rich. He's a very articulate pro-Brexit conservative person. But the thing is, he's one of those people who thinks, oh, well, we're going to have to close down the National Health Service. We don't have enough money for public services. So, yes, he's a kind of authoritarian Tory, but at least his principles are right when it comes to Brexit. I think Brexit, by the way, is going to be a disaster, but not because of Brexit. It's because anybody that is criticising or doing something to challenge the hierarchy, the fascist hierarchy, the Nazi, I would even say, influenced hierarchy in the EU. I mean, Donald Tusk is from, people don't know this, he's from a long, long line of top aristocrats, German, Luxembourg-based aristocrats. And these people are actually a kind of monarchy. And their aristocracy, they believe they have the right to just control everything. They don't really want to take any notice of people. And they think they're being smart and clever by manoeuvring themselves into a position at the top of this massive bureaucracy where they're totally invulnerable, George. So nobody can get rid of them. Nobody can question or challenge them. And anyone that does is just simply removed.
Right. I've been doing a little research on C.S. Lewis. That's quite an interesting writer and author, is he not?
He certainly is, yeah. He was very friendly with J.R.R. Tolkien in Oxford, yeah.
Yeah, they met at a Tuesday morning at a little inn there and met with a literary group. And there were quite a few important, very famous people that came out of that group. And C.S. Lewis was one of them, and Tolkien was another.
Yeah, they were... There was a, I'm trying to remember the name of the guy, C.H. Charles, I think, who was, he's one of the most interesting people I ever came across. We're talking about the interwar period, really. And if you remember, you go back to the time of round about World War One. There was this amazing kind of archaeology wars going on between the British Empire and the Germans over in the Middle East. And almost everywhere was being dug up, and Egypt, of course.
Right.
Everywhere was being dug up. And the idea was to try and grab this stuff and take it back to London or to Berlin. And, you know, it got quite nasty sometimes. As to, you know, we found this one first, no you didn't. And then they would have to wrangle with the Egyptian authorities or whatever as to who was going to have a claim. If you go to Berlin, you go to the museum there, you will see the entire Ishtar Gate of Babylon in the middle of Berlin in a museum.
Right, so the Zeus altar. Altar of Zeus is there, yeah.
The whole thing is just there in a museum. You know,
right.
It's amazing actually looking at this stuff from like 3,000 years ago, these gorgeous tiles. But, I mean, it's a bit of a sinister place because they were seriously pagan. They were worshipping bulls, worshipping unicorns, worshipping stags, all this kind of thing. But that was what they were into in those days, very, like, sort of hardcore pagan stuff. But look, getting back to the point with C.H. Charles, as they were digging all this stuff out in the Middle East, they were bringing a lot of it back to Oxford, these old manuscripts they were finding. And so C.H. Charles was the first person to translate into English a lot of the, what they call pseudepigrapha from the Old Testament and apocrypha from the New Testament. And these were books, religious books, spiritual books, if you want, written by people of faith. Some of them probably fake as well, and putting them into the English language. These are books which are not in the in the official canon. Worth saying as well that if you go back to something like the Jerusalem Bible, or which is a Catholic Bible, a modern Catholic Bible, in fact Tolkien was involved in translating that as well. That there's a lot of stuff in there which is not in the in the King James Version, not in the Protestant Bible. I think the Protestants actually took out some of the best content of the Bible. Many books are really good. I mean, I was looking recently at a book from the Old Testament called Ecclesiasticus, and it is long, it's brilliant, it's witty. You know, it's one of the proverbs, for example, is it's something to do with having a real problem, actually it being extremely tiring making up proverbs.
Oh, gosh, funny. Yeah.
And this is, all this stuff is from like 3,000-4,000 years ago. And yet that was extracted from the Bible by the Protestants, by Luther and the rest of them, much to the detriment, I think, of modern biblical scholarship and culture. But what C.H. Charles was doing is he was looking at fragments sometimes, but sometimes entire books from the Old Testament that weren't even in the Catholic Bible. So we're talking about, for example, the Book of Enoch, which has got quite a lot about apocalyptic and what we call eschatological writings, saying, talking about what's going to happen at the end of the world from Enoch's point of view. You know, so I'm not saying that this is, you know, I'm not qualified to say that these should be in the Bible, but there's certainly interesting things are worth looking at. And he was part of that circle with Tolkien and C.S. Lewis in Oxford that used to meet in the pub on the Tuesday evening.
Right. What about the Dead Sea Scrolls, Tony? Were they, was that a legitimate research effort, or was it to cover up certain things? What, there's debate about that.
Oh, there is, isn't there? Look, this is a really, really knotty one. I personally, having had a look at it, I think in a way it's a way to distract from some of the stuff that C.H. Charles was bringing up. And you can actually get these. I think it's called The Lost Books of Eden. You can get a publication which is, in print still, which is some of his translations of these pseudepigrapha and the apocrypha. So pseudepigrapha is the lost books of the Old Testament, and the apocrypha is the ones from the New Testament. But look, the point here being that you've got a mixture of real stuff and not real stuff. So the Dead Sea Scrolls, I think, I don't think a lot of them haven't actually properly been released. And also, it's been very much captured by the Rockefeller Museum, I think it's called, the Rockefeller Center in Israel, has completely kept the mockers on these. Personally, I would suggest that there's maybe not much in them, and that this is a sort of mystery to put on TV series and things like that. The real interesting stuff, I think, is just available for anyone to read who wants to in the C.H. Charles and other similar translations.
Right, right. Well, where do we go in Syria? What's happening there? What have you gotten any good feedback or anything from the recent changes there and with the U.S. policy and so forth?
Well, I've seen that the Russians are sort of digging in, aren't they, George?
Yeah, they're not going to give just run away from the deal at all.
Well, you may as well say Syria is part of the Russian Federation, really. It's not just a military thing. They obviously need those bases. They've got to keep those bases. They're not going to give them up. And Russia will, take out anybody that decides that they're going to try and remove the Tarsus base and the other bases they've got in Syria. I mean, it's absolutely crucial that they keep them. It's crucial for world peace that they keep them, and for the balance of power in the Middle East. So, Assad and Putin are winning, and there's been most of the mercenaries, and let's not call them rebels, let's just call them what they are, the mercenaries paid via Switzerland, of course Switzerland was involved in World War II as well in helping the Nazis, so it's not so surprising to hear that the Swiss money launderers and crooked bankers are helping fund ISIS. Nobody really seems to be talking about this, apart from people like Scott Bennett and various others. He's the former U.S. Army psychological warfare officer, who's a bit of a whistleblower and done a fantastic job, I think. And there's also evidence from the U.S. that the Gulf states have been funding terrorism through Switzerland as well. So it seems pretty clear. And interestingly enough, that's where Theresa May is for the next 2 weeks. She's been already in Switzerland for a week. Apparently she's having a walking holiday in the Alps. But I don't believe that for 1 minute. I think what she's doing is she's sitting down with some of these crooked, evil Swiss bankers who've been financing wars and trying to run the world from underneath their Smaug mountain, like going back to the Lord of the Rings, this sort of
right.
People who are loaded with money, and they are manipulating events, and they're making sure that Theresa May is going to do what she's told, and giving her orders. I mean, let's not forget this is the Bank for International Settlements, which is the central banker's central bank, where they all meet and just decide policy. The politicians really are just kind of hangers-on, and if they don't follow orders to the letter, then they're gone within days nowadays.
Right, that's very, very interesting. That BIS during World War II was helping the Nazis funnel money out
exchange. The main problem was that it funded, it basically, it didn't have to do it, but it funded Hitler's rearmament in the late 1930s, in the mid-1930s onwards, you know. All of the rebuilding of plants to make aircraft, to make tanks, to make munitions, ammunition, etc., was all funded from Switzerland. And, you know, this is the thing. If the Swiss wave their magic wand over a specific politician, then that politician, just everything just works for them. You know, this is the way things work nowadays. It's a bit like the Wizard of Oz, you know. You see one person and you think, oh, they're making a good job, their country is being successful. But actually, behind the scenes, it's only because the Swiss bankers or whoever they are have decided that they like this politician, they want this person to succeed. You'll probably find good things happening in France under Macron, but only because he's following the bankster's orders.
Yeah, he started with getting chummy with Trump. What's that about? And I went, you know, it's hard to figure. Well, Macron is what, a Rothschild agent anyway, right?
Yeah, he definitely is a Rothschild agent.
Sure, sure.
And yeah, he's. I see he's also a bit of a warmonger when it comes to Syria. You know, he's suddenly.
Yes, he is, isn't
he's
he?
Doing all the things that they want him to do. Including clamping down on Islam in this anti-Semitic religious hate kind of fashion. Now, Islam is not the problem. Yeah, Islam is actually the only reason Islam is a powerful and popular religion is because of the Crusades, because these stupid Christian Templars and Hospitallers, etc., went trudging across, burning, pillaging, killing, etc., in the name of Christ. All of the people in the Middle East said, well, there must be something better than this. And, of course, that's when Muhammad popped up on the scene and actually formed a very, very good religion. Actually, if you look at what they were doing back in those days, Muhammad and his followers were very, very sensible. They said, well, look, we're going to have religious toleration. Yeah. So, for example, in Jerusalem, there was no attacking the Jews. There was no stopping them worshipping in the way they wanted to. They said, well, we'll just live side by side. We'll do our Muslim thing. You do your Jewish thing. It's only when the Zionists came back, of course, in 1948, the terrorists of the Zionists came back, that the whole thing of religious intoleration flared up again. And, of course, we've seen that over the last couple of weeks at the Temple Mount and the Al-Aqsa Mosque.
Right. The turn of the century in Jerusalem and those main cities in Israel were very peaceful, weren't they, around 1900 or so?
They certainly were, up until 1948 is when it all started kicking off. I mean, I interviewed a guy who was a British soldier over there in the 1940s, and he said that essentially that there was no interest. I mean, the British mandate was a very sensible situation. What they had was they had the whole of the British state had liaison officers throughout the civil service with the Jews and the Arabs, because they knew that the Jews and Arabs were each other's throats. So they said, well, we're going to deal with both. We're not just, you know, we're not going to have, you know, be partisan. And what happened was that the Israeli terrorists just assassinated all of the Arab liaison officers. So we're talking about everybody that the British spoke to who was an Arab then was just killed by the Israeli terrorists because they were spying on them. And as soon as they saw an Arab speaking to anyone from the British Mandate, army, police, etc., they just kill them. And so that's what that state was founded on, is religious hatred. And it was really interesting chatting to both Stephen Sizer, who's written a lot about this, Christian Zionism, is a former vicar who was banned from speaking about the Middle East, would you believe, by the Church of England, because he was so anti, you know, wrote a book which is very anti-Zionist. And also Gilad Atzmon, who's a British, well, he's actually Israeli, but he lives in Britain now, a jazz musician, who's written a lot about the whole sort of attempt to intimidate, attack, and destroy anybody that supports the Palestinian cause, you know, in a very pernicious way. For example, through, you know, smearing you to your boss to get you the sack if you're a journalist, you know, this kind of thing. And they're very, very well organized. And it's an extremely effective way of shutting down criticism of the Zionists.
Right. Do you have any other closing comments here when we close down the program here, Tony, that you need to tell our listening audience?
Well, I would say a few things about, I mean, World War II is always in my mind.
Right.
Because we're suffering now. from the treachery that happened both sides of the Atlantic at the end of the war. I'm talking about with the Dulles brothers in the US.
Right.
And I'm talking about with people like Winston Churchill, actually, and his assistant, Major Desmond Morton, at the end of the war. Over, I mean, you may, you know, I think the story of the Operation Paperclip and Dulles, etc., and the assassination of John F. Kennedy is fairly well known over in the US, you know, the Nazis really being behind that. But the story in Britain is not so well understood that Winston Churchill himself was part of this deal, which was done, it seems, around about September 1944, that the British and the Americans would join with the remains of the German army to attack the Russians, and they would use the nuclear bomb for the purpose. Carter Heydrich, for example, I don't know if you come across him in the States, he's written a fantastic book. It's called Critical Mass, all about the way that the Nazi uranium, enriched uranium, was used as part of the Manhattan Project, possibly in the Trinity test, because it was desperately needed, enriched uranium, by the Americans to build. I mean, although the British actually designed the bomb, Fish and Piles in Birmingham designed it, Churchill realised that during the war Britain was under such stress we didn't have the resources to actually build it, so that's why the Manhattan Project happened. And then what you'll find is that Churchill and his friends, under Operation Unthinkable, actually wanted to use the atomic weapons to bomb Moscow and to kill...
My God! Well, it gets wild, doesn't it?
Huh? Launch a mass attack against the Russians. I think, actually, in a way, that this was what the Nazis were planning, and the Swiss, who financed them, from the word go. And they've been doing this for years and years, George, banging their head against a brick wall. And that brick wall is the wall of the Kremlin. You know, they want to get in there. They want to control Russia like they play the rest of Europe and America, like a fiddle. You know, they control it through the banks. And the Russians aren't having it. And in fact, I think what's happened is the Russians and the Chinese and other people around the world are starting to realize what their game is. And that means, of course, once everyone realizes what your game is, that means your game is up.
Right, right. That money game, that money power is all powerful, isn't it?
Well, it is and it isn't, because the money is used to buy the media and it's used to buy the politicians, mainly. I mean, there's other things as well, of course, you know, but the media being publishing, printing of all sorts, television, radio, newspapers, books, magazines, all that stuff is now almost totally controlled by the banks, because they just buy up or close down or sue anyone that's publishing something that they don't like. I mean, it's actually like a war zone, the publishing world. And, of course, the political parties are similar. I think Jeremy Corbyn in the Labour Party represents the only real resistance around to that. I mean, we've seen other parties like Syriza, etc., and some others around Europe and Spain and Italy, places like that, trying to resist. But Jeremy Corbyn seems to be making actually a very, very good job of it. We'll see if he manages to survive, and if he's not bumped off like one of his other colleagues before, like it looks like Robin Cook, the Foreign Secretary, was bumped off, as well as John Smith, the former Labour leader, possibly also bumped off as well. So let's hope Jeremy Corbyn survives to revive the spirits and the hope of people in Britain and other parts of the West. I think there's a lot of people. I mean, he's one of the things is with Brexit. He's definitely a Brexiteer. He understands that there's no half measures. We're going to have to leave the European Union. We have to leave the European Court of Justice. We have to leave the European Parliament. We have to leave the European Commission, and we'll have to become like Norway, Switzerland, and Liechtenstein and Iceland, which is one step removed. So we have our political control and authority and our courts separate, but we continue to trade. Now, the Europeans want to doing everything they can. I'm talking about the people from Brussels doing everything they possibly can to stop that happening, George.
Oh, man, I'll tell you. Well, Tony, boy, you ended the program here with a bang. I'll tell you, you're always you're very, very deep on this stuff, and we certainly appreciate your views and your opinions.
I don't credit myself. I credit some of the fascinating people who come on to our show every Friday on KCFM in Bristol. Well,
yeah, we have that click off up on our site for people to come into. We sure do.
Yeah. Just that, you know, I'm really, really honoured by some of the amazing guests that we have on, like, for example, Gilad Atzmon, this Israeli-born jazz musician. Last Friday, talking about the what he calls what is it now? Something Inc. Hate Inc. That's right. And he's talking about the anti-Semitism industry. The way that it's taxpayer funded. So the more accusations that are made of anti-Semitism, the more money taxpayers' money gets spent, and the more evidence they supposedly accrue of all this anti-Semitism. So it's going off in a McCarthyite spiral.
Right. It's bad. I know. I've been looking at it for 35 years, so I understand. But we certainly appreciate your opinions and the interview tonight, Tony. Thank you for being with us.
Thank you, George. If anyone wants to follow up some of those interviews, it's thisweek.org.uk.
Okay. Thank you a lot. Bye-bye. Good night.
George, all the best.
Okay. Cheers.